and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. Today is Sunday, September the 1st of 2019, and we're sitting here in the meeting house at Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, and we just had Lord's Day corporate worship, and we're sitting here now about to record a podcast, and I have here as a guest David Larlam and his wife Monica, who are worshiping with us today. They're on vacation from the UK here in the US, and we also enjoyed some fellowship with them yesterday, lunch and supper together and some conversation. And I thought it might be interesting just to record an interview, primarily with David, to hear a little bit about his story. And so I want to talk to him about his testimony, a little bit how he came to know the Lord. I think that's always encouraging for people to hear. And then about his service with the Trinitarian Bible Society, where he served as the Assistant General Secretary for 20 years, now retired. And maybe he could tell us a little bit about the work of the Trinitarian Bible Society and some of his experiences with it. But let's just start off with learning a little bit about David. So, David, welcome. Glad to have you here today.
Thank you.
Good. Has it been a good visit to the U.S. so far?
Very good. Not very long. We've only been here since Wednesday, so it's still quite early days.
But you're used to the U.S. You've been here multiple times.
We've been here about a dozen times since 98.
Awesome. Awesome.
Since I joined TBS, in fact, that was the year I joined.
Okay. Yeah. So let's just begin with telling me a little bit about you. Where were you born? Where were you from? And then how was it that you came to be a Christian?
Good question. Born and raised in London, I don't suppose I've moved more than 5 or 6 miles since I was born.
That's unbelievable. I mean, how many people could say that they haven't moved more than 5 miles from where they were born?
I've only lived in four places because my wife and I married in 72. And we lived in a little attic for a few months.
Huh.
And then we bought a house, and then we moved 5 years later, and we've been there ever since, 42 years same house.
And where's the neighborhood where you live in London?
It's Camberwell, which is, if American listeners, for example, might know of the Elephant and Castle, which is a well-known landmark in London, near or where the Metropolitan Tabernacle Evangelical Church is.
Mm-hmm.
Good friends of ours, about a mile from where we live and a mile from our church. We're both very close to the tabernacle.
So you grew up in that community?
Not really. No, I grew up in a place called Streatham, mm-hmm. which is about 5 or 6 miles south of there.
Okay.
Then I moved when I was 11, 1960, to Norbury. And that was significant because that was used in my conversion in a strange sort of way. I had a completely ungodly, by that I mean not violently wicked, but total lack of interest in God. My family were not Christian at all. I think I went to church once when I was three to some Church of England place just so they could get rid of me. And I lost a pair of gloves or something and they wouldn't let me go again. I don't even remember that. I was just told about it later. And even though I went to what we call a public school, you would call a private school, and they used to have religious instruction, and they used to have a church service every term, three times a year, I don't think the minister was a Christian.
Hmm.
So it didn't make any impact on me at all.
Hmm.
And so I left school, and looking at it from the point of view of the election and grace of God, which I like to do, you might think, well, how was the Lord ever going to save this guy who grew up totally without God, worked hard at school, very few interests other than work and sport, which I really enjoyed, no contact with churches, Christians, anything like that at all. But God was working in mysterious ways. And I was hoping to go to university and be a teacher.
Mm.
And I was going through school and got to the whatever grade they call them nowadays, I was nearly 18. And I'd just taken and passed what they call A-level, which was the highest certificate of education below university degree, in subjects as esoteric as Greek, Latin and Greek history.
Hmm.
But nonetheless, I planned to stay at school for another year or two, then go on to university and study English. That was my great love. And maybe become an English teacher. That was how I was thinking. My brother was there as well. He was a year younger, and he had similar aspirations.
Hmm.
And suddenly, in the summer of 1966, our parents told us that they'd run out of money.
Hmm.
We thought they were quite well-to-do. They ran a sports shop and toy shop.
Hmm.
And we didn't realise that it wasn't doing very well.
Mm.
And so they broke the news to us, you've got to go and get a job. And so I had no idea what to do. You can't just get a job as a teacher without a degree. And Greek, Latin and Greek history doesn't prepare you much for the real world in London in 66. So I was completely at a loss. I didn't know what to do at all. And a neighbour of ours, or just a few doors up the road, he was retired, but he'd worked for the Bank of England. And we were on reasonable terms with him, not the very friendly. My dad used to like him. So he said, well, why don't you apply for a job at the Bank of England, which was the top echelon of banking. So he arranged or helped me to get an interview. And in those days, it was quite easy to get a job. And if I had behaved myself at the interview and had a reasonable knowledge of money, I'm sure I could have got in. But I didn't know much about economics or politics or the world in general. I knew about Latin and Greek and football and things like that. Soccer, as you call it. So I was at a loss at this interview to make much of the impression. And it was, don't call us, we'll call you. So we went back to this neighbour and he said, well, you started at the top. Work your way down. You know, there's lots of other banks. Try one of them. And this is all instrumental in how I became a Christian. So I went to another bank and they said, oh, you've got A-levels. You must be clever. So we'll take you on. So I said, well, yeah, but they're in Greek, Latin and Greek history. That's nothing to do with money and banking, is it? No, that doesn't matter. You can work with dead people. So I had a
job. Not too many complaints from them, apparently.
No. So I had a job in 66 onwards and worked in that bank or one of its affiliates for 32 years, mainly in probate and trust work, which was fascinating and absolutely enjoyable and a lot of hard work. And I found that I wasn't at all interested in the Lord, of course, then, but later, not much later, I became a Christian. And thereafter, as a Christian, trying to help people who are bereaved, widowed, desolate, that was a great help to me to get through it all. And occasionally there was opportunities to witness, and people seemed to appreciate the word of God in that context.
So how was it then that you became a Christian?
Well, I'd been at the bank a few months. This would have been late 66. And a girl came to work for us who lived 120 miles away. So she was coming to London. And I didn't know her well, but we obviously were work colleagues and we chatted and not even became real friends. It was just a sort of a casual acquaintance in the workplace. She was homesick. And so she only lasted until early 67, I suppose. Went back home, couldn't stick working in London. And I didn't have any great feelings toward her. I didn't think I'd ever see her again. But then, amazingly, the bank used to send you on training courses. And they'd send you to far-flung places like the coast of Devon in December. And the waves were crashing through the foyer of the hotel. That was how grim it was. So there, and she was on the course. And I recognised her. So you're on a course with about 25 people. And I was very shy. And so I thought, oh, I know that girl. And you kind of gravitate towards those that you've met before. So anyway, we're on this course, and they leave you to your own devices in the evening. And so we went to the cinema, and we got chatting. And she was a Christian, but I didn't know what a Christian was. But I knew there was something different about her. She had something inward that I was not familiar with, and she seemed to have that peace, which was all to do with her being a Christian. But and she, I mean, she shouldn't have been going anywhere near me, because as a Christian, to even begin to develop a friendship with a guy who was not a Christian and had no interest in the things of God was very foolish. So, but God in his wisdom made it sort of continue. Anyway, the course ended after a week or two, and we obviously lived 120 miles apart, but we got a bit friendlier over those few days and said, oh, we'd write to each other. So we used to write almost every week, and she would tell me things about the Lord, and I would completely ignore them. And then we were friendly enough for me to go down and visit her on the odd weekend, say once a month. Got to know her parents, who weren't Christians. And she didn't push it. She used to go to the church on the Sunday, I guess. In fact, I think I used to go back on the Sunday to avoid it. But then one Friday night, because I used to go down on a Friday, she said, we're going out to a meeting. And I didn't know what it was, and I had no idea. And if I'd known, I wouldn't have gone. But it was actually an evangelistic crusade. Not that I favour that, frankly, as biblical evangelism, but I didn't know any different. So I went along. She said, if you don't come, you've got to stay with my mum and dad, and that seemed boring. So I went with her, not knowing what it was. And, of course, you go into it, it was in the church, and there was a preacher, and there was probably a choir, hundreds and hundreds of people, and I was right at the back. And I'd never heard the gospel before, as far as I know. If I had, I never listened. So that was the first time ever that the gospel was preached. I'm not even sure the name of the man.
I was going to ask you, do you know who was preaching?
I think it might have been somebody like Don Summers. There was a man at the time who was quite a famous evangelist in those contexts called Dick Saunders. It wasn't him. But I have a vague idea that it was the same initials. And I think Don Summers might have been the man.
And anyway, what type of church was it, do you know?
Just a fairly run-of-the-mill evangelical type church. I think it was Baptist in the middle of or west end of Bournemouth, which is where she lived. But I was in no position to gauge what sort of place it was. As far as I was concerned, it was just a church, and they were preaching about Christ. And I felt really bad inside. And the Lord was convicting me of sin, which I'd never thought about before. And for me to think that I was a sinner and need to do something about it was devastating. And of course, as they do in these type of meetings, they were careful to try and weed out the false. And they said, if you've been troubled by anything you've heard, we want you to put your hand up. And so I did. And I noticed hundreds or dozens, lots of people around the auditorium put their hands up. And then they said, well, if we don't want you to mess around, you know, if you're really concerned about this and you want to find out more, we want you to come down the front. And I thought, I was at the back. And I thought, no way am I going down the front. And then I thought, well, there's loads of other people. Maybe I can kind of mingle with them. So I don't know to this day how I did it. I don't remember walking from the back to the front, down in front of all these people. And I looked around for all these other people, and there's two people went down the front apart from me. Which was good in a way, because the Lord was sort of weeding out the pretenders, you might say. But I was concerned enough to actually do something about it. And they talked to you, they took you to one side, they counseled you about what the gospel says. Whether I became a Christian then and there, or whether it was gradually fulfilled over the next few weeks, I'm not entirely sure. But of course, one thing they did, which was good, was saying, now, where do you live? And of course, I told them I live in London. Well, it's good if you go to a church. Unlike Billy Graham, for example, who sends you to the Roman Catholic Church or anywhere else that happens to be nearby, they were at least concerned for me to go to a sound church. So they contacted another church in London near where I lived, actually called the same name, Lansdowne Evangelical Church. The amazing thing was that my wife, as I'd never met, was going there. And so they contacted me. The church in London detailed a man who lived in the same road as I did, about half a mile away, to come and superintend me and usher me to the church and befriend me and so on, which he did. And I didn't like it much. I was so completely naive when it came to the things of God. I thought I might be much better off. This was the summer, or getting into the summer. I could sit in the garden sunbathing and read some sort of Christian magazine. I thought that would be good. And this man said, no, 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 it's much, much better, very important that you come and worship the thing, the Lord. So he took me to this church, big church, famous minister called Derek Prime, although I'm not sure he was still there
at that time.
I think he was, but he was coming to the end of his ministry towards that time. But it didn't make a great impression on me. I felt like a fish out of water. I was very shy. Nobody really came and befriended me and spoke to me. And these were middle-class sort of people that I felt uncomfortable amongst. Not many of my age group. So the man who was looking after me, a dear, dear man of God, now gone to glory, called Michael Leonard, he persevered. He wouldn't let me kind of stay away. So, one thing in God's providence that worked so well for me, when I didn't really have much enthusiasm about going to this place, I was so new yet to the things of God. He used to run a Sunday school in the back streets of Camberwell, 5 miles away. And so he would take people, or he would go there, run his Sunday school with the local lads and lasses, and then bring them back to leafy Norbury, where I lived, and he lived, to give them tea and befriend them. But he took me in the other direction, so he took me there as part of this enterprise. And as soon as I met these young fellas and girls, I felt much more at ease and at home with them. They were people like me. They were a similar age group. And what God was doing in an amazing way in those years, 66, 7, 8, was, this was 68 by now. So, he was saving teenagers in that area, a mini revival. A church where we now go was very fallen down. The building was fallen down. It wasn't even a church building. It was an old garage premises. Elderly people there. The minister was getting on in years. But our present minister, who's been there 53 years now, he was brought along to do a work amongst youngsters. He was a London City missionary. And the elderly ones in the congregation who had no vigour or even local presence, because a lot of them didn't live around there, they said, well, you go out on the streets and meet children and bring them to the church and have a youth club and that sort of thing, which he did with great vigour and ability. And under God, many of them were saved. I'm talking about 20, 25 youngsters, boys and girls, all from ungodly backgrounds. None of them, like me, had any interest in the things of God. Most of them lived in the immediate area. And I became one of those, even though I was 5 miles away and kind of came in on Sundays. Started going to that church, felt much more at ease there. So, strangely, the church I'd gone to a little bit, where Monica went, never met her that I know of. She was still there. She knew nothing about where I was, although she obviously knew Michael Leonard. And our meeting was sometime in the following year that was to happen. God organized it.
So were you baptized in that church?
Yes, but a bit later, because the church, as I say, wasn't a church building. It was an old converted garage or tumble-down place. We had to go, we had to leave there in 72, but the church elders had the foresight to know that they couldn't stay long. I think it was owned by the council, and they'd been given notice to go. So they had a plot of land about hundreds of yards away, close, and they built the present church on that plot of land over the period sort of 69, 70 or so.
And you've been a member of that church?
You've been a member. His first membership was, the church was inaugurated and a new building on that site, 1972. I was one of the original members, as was Monica, I think. She'd come by then and joined us. And we were baptized, or I was baptized, she'd been baptized younger. So I was baptized at the church, which had a baptistry, the first one to be baptized. We were the first ones to be married there.
So it was
all amazing how God kind of took me from that background, plonked me in Camberwell, which seemed so unlikely, in that environment where I still am now 50 years later.
Well, let's get you married first, and then we'll talk more about the church. So how did God and his providence bring Monica into your life?
Well, she knew Michael Leonard at Lansdowne, and she obviously was aware of, and perhaps must have come to that old mission building like I did with him.
Hmm.
And so she began to mingle with the people that I was with, and I didn't notice her so much, but she noticed me, I suppose. Hmm. Being 6'3" was probably helpful. So she kind of ran up to me in the street a little while before her 21st birthday. So we're now talking about summer 69.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me to her birthday party, which was in September 69, 21. And I didn't really know who she was. I vaguely recognised her, but I thought, who is this strange girl asking me to her birthday party? But the thing I remember most about that was that Derek Prime, the minister from Lansdowne, came to the party, which was a very kind of sedate affair. You know, I don't think it was any music or anything like that. It was just food and a gathering of youngsters and the odd present. And Derek Prime preached a little sermon there. I thought, wow, this girl is something else. You know, you go to a birthday party and you have the minister,
a sermon.
The minister comes and preaches the gospel.
Nice.
And I even remember that he preached on that episode in the Old Testament where Elisha was, I can't quite remember the reference, but yeah, there was a shooting of arrows and the beating on the ground. And,
right.
He didn't do it enough.
Mm.
And Elisha was involved in that episode, wasn't he?
Wow.
So that was amazing. So we started going out together after sort of September 69.
And how long have you guys been married now?
Since May 72.
Okay.
So we had a courtship and engagement for over a year, I think it was.
And you have how many children and grandchildren?
We've got three children, all believers, all come to faith independently and despite us, I would say, obviously by the grace of God. One is a deacon in Trinity Grace Church in Ramsbottom, up in the north of England, near in Ramsbottom, near Manchester.
Hmm.
And he went up there, when was it, 5 years ago?
Hmm. 8 years ago.
8 years ago. Because he married a girl from that town, or that area.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to live in London. Well, he did live in London for a while, just round the corner from us. Came to our church probably 2 years or so before his job changed. And they couldn't afford anywhere to live that was big enough, that was around where we lived.
Hmm.
So they ended up going up to Ramsbottom. So we've got one son, married, happily married Christian deacon in his church, two daughters, aged 3 and 8, 7? 7. 7. Up in Ramsbottom.
Hmm.
One son and one daughter in Camberwell, both solid members of our church. Daughter
nice.
Unmarried, living about a mile away, if that. Son, wife, four children, living up the other direction, another mile up the road.
What do you think has been, what's been the experience and what's the advantage of being in a church for many, many years? And because many Christians, it's, I don't know what it's like in London, in the U.S. at least, it's a very mobile society. People go to one church, they go to another. But, I mean, you've been in that church a long time.
Yeah, 50 years. Well, one element, I'm kind of thinking on my feet a bit to answer that very important question. One element that is our pastor, who is that same man who was the London City missionary, became our pastor in 72 when we got married. And he was the best man at my wedding. He has always preached the working church ethos. Much like the Metropolitan Tabernacle, which is not far away, and we're very kindred spirits in many ways. So we all live within walking distance of the church, I would say. Although modern society being as it is, most people drive, even if it's only, we're a mile away. It takes 10 minutes to drive.
So right.
People are laughing who might live a mile away from their church in America and it takes 20 seconds or something. but it takes 10 minutes in London traffic to get a mile. We could walk it, we have done. But we are often giving lifts to somebody one way or the other. But we all live within close proximity of the church. There's a lot of meetings throughout the Lord's Day, throughout the week. Youth clubs, Bible studies, two a week Bible studies, Sunday school, all manner of clubs going on. Because our pastor had the view, and this was almost unique, I've never come across this anywhere else. He had this ready-made group of young people who'd been saved in a short space of time and knew nothing about the Word of God. They'd never had contact with Christianity in their upbringing, like me. And we had a huge appetite. So he was used under God to teach us. That's his great strength, his teaching from the Word of God. So there was even a Bible study already, midweek, Wednesday, which the erstwhile minister used to run. He did it sometimes. But we wanted something else. We wanted another one without the elderly ones there, if you like. So we used to go to some guy's flat, and then we went into his home. He was the teacher, and we would go through everything and teach us. Like, it would start at 8 o'clock, and we might still be there at 11 o'clock. And we would just lap up the Word of God. Now, one thing he was very conscious of, we all came from ungodly homes, and we were living in the main with parents. So what he didn't want was for us to go home, say, even on a Sunday evening after the service, or to spend weeknight evenings at home with the television, with our ungodly parents, families, and just imbibe the world. So he hit on the idea of, okay, I'm not going to go to them, they can come to us. So these meetings grew up mainly to get us out of our homes into working for the Lord, because these were evangelistic youth clubs and so forth, and we would have youngsters in from the area. We would go out literally to find them sometimes. We would have an open-air meeting where we would go and preach within near vicinity of the church.
I like how you called it a working ethos for the church.
A working ethos. So he believed in, you're a Christian, this is your church, God has called you here, you stay here until God says you go, which is a different perspective than some might have. So there's going to be no reason for us to leave and go to another church unless the church begins to go off the straight and narrow.
What's the pastor's name again?
Fred Hintz. It's an anagram of Zenith, H-I-N-T-Z-E. And he's been the pastor, and the teaching has been consistent and stable for all those years.
Does he do expositional preaching?
He does verse-by-verse expositional preaching, which is unusual these days in my experience. And he'll do that twice on the Lord's Day and twice during the week on Bible study nights. The only difference between, two differences from the Bible study, is the Wednesday one is followed by a prayer meeting, and the exposition is pretty much like a Lord's Day sermon for about 40 minutes, then the prayer meeting. on the Friday night. This was something particularly that we relished and were introduced to as youngsters with no knowledge. It's verse by verse, but he would preach through a verse, and then he'd open it up to us to ask questions, to debate, to disagree, to argue. And people did argue, and we've cut our teeth on this over the years. Youngsters now grown up into their 50s, 60s, 70s have always had that freedom to debate and disagree in love. And the other thing he instituted, which was consonant with don't let them go home and while away their time in the world, with discussion groups. So on a Sunday evening, after the open air meeting, starting at 9:30 now, maybe 9 in early days, we would have a discussion group for about 2 hours, hour and a half. Same group, mainly of youngsters, discussing the messages we've heard, discussing things we needed to know, like, you're a Christian now. What do you do when somebody asks you about abortion or homosexuality or drink or smoking? We needed to know these things because we didn't know. We had no inbuilt teaching about how Christians are.
So a typical Sunday then is from when the morning
11 in the morning till 11 at night, with Sunday school in the afternoon, adult Bible class in the afternoon. You come home for lunch, you go out again, you come and have a bit of tea, and then you go out again.
Wow.
And then you have, after the service, you have either the open air or a prayer meeting simultaneously for it, and then you have the discussion group.
And you said for the last 50 years, is it every other week there's open air ministry? It's every week
every
in central
week.
London.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the place? Is it different places? You go to the same place?
We're always within, our church is tucked away in a little back street. So if we had it outside the church, we'd hardly meet anybody. And we'd just annoy people in the flats nearby. We tried that. We know that's what happens. Although sometimes when we were in the early days, we might just go and put leaflets through doors, knock on doors and talk to people that way.
Right.
But we really wanted somewhere where we would meet a lot of people because they were there anyway. So within a mile of the church, certainly within a mile, is Camberwell Green, which is a huge transport hub, buses everywhere, big hospital nearby, people coming and going to that, loads of restaurants, lots of drunks around, just a cosmopolitan mix of people of all languages and nationalities nowadays. It's a big Afro-Caribbean area. There's lots of Hispanic speakers nowadays, Eastern Europeans. You can tell by the restaurants, you know, there's virtually 15 different nationalities of restaurants within 150 yards.
I'm curious, over the course of the last 50 years in doing that open-air ministry, has it changed much? Are people more open, less open, less antagonistic?
It's changed a lot in those terms. The venue's changed a few times. We also go near the Oval Cricket Ground, which is another big concourse where you meet a lot of people. What's changed is the attitude of people. The attitude used to be antagonistic, used to be confrontational in the right sense. So we would have vehement debates and discussions with people who would hate what we were doing and be religiously opposed to us, for example, or be philosophically opposed. And it would wear you out sort of mentally, but at least you felt you were doing something in the battle. Nowadays, when we give out TBS tracks by the hundred, but people are so apathetic. They really are. They'll take a tract, they might screw it up and throw it on the floor, but more often they'll put it in their pocket, put it in their handbag. Most people go by with wires coming out their ears and they're talking on their phone. They're not. They barely look at you as you give them a tract. You're just a kind of
kind of a myth. They don't have enough convictions even to be angry with you.
They don't seem to have any opinions.
Yeah.
So for somebody to stop and ask you a question, even the only people sometimes that do that are Christians. You know, oh, you're old-fashioned. You know, why do you do this? You know, and we have to say to them, you know, the biblical warranty for going out and preaching the gospel to people. Because they're not going to come flocking into your church if you just sit there and open the doors. And we meet many professing Christians who can't understand that. And sadly, we meet many I underline the word professing because many of them don't seem to know the Lord. They trek miles across London to huge churches, charismatic type churches, Pentecostal type churches, where they don't hear the gospel. They hear other stuff, and they are having healings and that sort of business. And we meet them more or less where they live, and they're going all the way over there, and they think that's good for their soul, and we're trying to urge them to come and hear the gospel as it should be. And we're very simple. In the past, we've used a megaphone, usually to get over the traffic. Sometimes the police have said they've had a complaint, we have to put it away, and so we do without. Now we don't even use a megaphone. So we preach with our naked voices, with a big waist-high board that we stand behind with TBS tracks on either side, so there's no dispute about what we're doing. And we have perhaps 8 to 10 people with tracks, handing out tracks on different corners, vantage points, engaging people with the gospel, if they'll stop and ask and have a conversation. But most people just
walk by,
which has changed enormously over the years, I think.
Let me switch gears a little bit. So, and you may want to talk more or less about this, but you had a career in banking, over 30 years in banking. And then you got to the point where you came to retirement from that, transitioned from that. And the last 20 years, you've been you've been working with Trinitarian Bible Society. So do you want to talk a little bit about the banking, or you want to talk about the transition to Trinitarian Bible Society? Maybe tell us a little bit about TBS, what it does, some of its history and so forth.
Just a little bit about the way being a Christian in banking was challenging and yet enjoyable. I mean, I was dealing with people in the main who had been bereaved, who were literally bursting into tears while I was talking to them. There was once an occasion I mentioned earlier to somebody here, a lady whose sister lived in England, died and left a lot of money, but she lived in California. So she flew all the way over from California to meet me. I remember once phoning up her lawyer, and you could hear the waves crashing on the shore at 7 o'clock in the morning when I was speaking to him. Anyway, she came over, and she was practically, as soon as she walked into the office, she burst into tears because she was so upset, obviously, from her sister dying. And I didn't really know what to do. I mean, she was a middle-aged lady, and I was probably 30-something. But I'd read in my Bible that morning, and I always had my Bible on the desk and nearby, verse in 1 Peter 5, I think it is, about cast all your cares upon him, and he cares for you. And so in the midst of her sort of tears, I was telling her that. And she was so taken, she asked me to write it down and sort of took it away as a prize, prize possession. Whether she ever, I don't think she had any real saving knowledge of it, of the law, but it helped at the time. And so she seemed appreciative. But I also found the challenge of being a Christian, having strict moral standards. Some of the things that were going on in banking, particularly latterly, were very unscrupulous to my mind. People had targets, people had incentives to do business but cut corners and never mind the client so much. And that's what initially, eventually led to my early retirement at the age of 50, that I could not work under those circumstances. And I told my manager so, and he was sympathetic, though he wasn't remotely a Christian man. And he arranged something which, to this day, I'm not sure anybody else ever benefited from this scheme that the bank came up with. Maybe one or two. It was very, very short-lived. But they had something going in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, where it would be their way of donating money to charity, or one of many ways, probably. If the situation presented itself and the charity involved was sufficiently of longevity and standard, they would second people who had a legitimate reason for wanting to go there to the charity and pay them bank manager's wages for a little while at least. So there I was, coming up to the age of 50, convinced I couldn't, before the Lord, carry on doing what I was doing because of the unscrupulousness of it. And we'd had visiting speakers from TBS at our church for a number of years. I knew about the work through them. Our church has always been authorized version, love the word of God. And so what they do was music to our ears. So as I prayed over it and thought, well, what now? This was in 97. I spoke to the speaker thinking maybe he could get me some sort of entree to maybe join TBS. And he asked me to write to the General Secretary, which I did. Unbeknown to me, the General Secretary had been praying for some time for an assistant, because the committee had said to him, you're wearing yourself out with all your work, you need an assistant. And he didn't really want one, but he was prepared to accept that, you know, he didn't want to burn out. So he was praying about it. It didn't advertise, nobody knew, and when my letter came in out of the blue about my situation and wondering if there might be an opening with TBS, I said, but I'd rather not deal with money. I've been dealing with that for 32 years and gets me down a bit. but anything else, you know, I'll sweep the floors, whatever. So he seemed to feel that this may be an answer to prayer. So he interviewed me. I met the chairman. It took an age to get through the process. So I joined them in August 98 after 32 years in banking. And that led to 20 years with TBS. But initially, my position was very junior, and I was assigned the title of assistant to the General Secretary. So I said, is that the same as assistant? Oh, no. Far, far different from that. And it took about 3 or 4 years before they took the two away. And I became the assistant General Secretary. It was actually the number two, TWO, to the boss.
So what was your role? What did you do for TBS?
Well, I was basically a servant doing, attaching myself along the different departments. It was the editorial department, the donations, the grants, the sales. So I got my hands dirty, as it were, in any of those areas.
And go back and tell me about the Trinitarian Bible Society. When did it begin? What is its mission and purpose?
It began in 1831, and that in itself was coming out of the British and Foreign Bible Society, because they disagreed with those people on two main things. One was the Apocrypha, which was often published even then back in the authorized version. They disagreed with that. And the other one was the deity of Christ, where in more and more of the meetings that were going on with the British and Foreign Bible Society, there was a lessening and even a downgrading of the deity of Christ, and that troubled some godly men who were upset about that. So they came out and formed their own offshoot.
And what, was Spurgeon involved with it in the founding?
No, that was well before him.
Okay.
I think he was only born in 26, 5 years before he founded, yes. But he was quite supportive in the latter period of his ministry. I think there is archived material to show that he was happy with what we were doing. But the imperative has always been the accurate and faithful translation of the Word of God from the best Masoretic Hebrew and Textus Receptus Greek texts. Mm-hmm. And the English Bibles now prevalent, English language Bibles, hardly any of them are based on those two texts, particularly the Textus Receptus, because over not that many years after the TBS was formed, in the 1800s, there was the Higher Critical Movement, there was the Westcott and Hort stuff, there was the attack on the inerrancy of the Bible, and all that came in like a flood in the later 1800s and the 1900s, so much so that many Bible versions in English were published based on the, what we would say is the wrong, the faulty text, the critical text as it's called. And hardly any nowadays are published at all on the correct New Testament text, the Textus Receptus. And you even get something like the New King James, which is a hybrid. They started out with a good intention, in my understanding, to take the King James authorized version with some of the old-fashioned expressions and phrases that people couldn't understand and update it in a minor way to help people to understand, but keep firmly on the same bedrock of translation. Not just the text, but the method of translation was formal equivalent, so you don't miss anything out. You convey exactly what's in the original, particularly, and this is where the AV is so good, it captures the cadences and the moods and the inner meanings of the Hebrew in particular and the Greek, which are poetic languages, and a lot of that comes across in the AV. It's poetically wonderful, which you don't get, even if they're accurate renditions in other versions.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to say the impetus to go by the authorized version, which right from the outset was the only one constitutionally acceptable to the TBS. And although we've never said, certainly it's never perfect. It's a translation. There's no such thing as a perfect translation. But it's the best by a long way. If another one comes along, as I often do, we will look at it. We will not say, oh, no, that's rubbish. But we will look at it honestly, and if it's not based on the correct text and it's not using formal equivalence, it won't get through the door. But theoretically, there could one day be a better translation.
But at present, the only English translation that's promoted by the TBS is the authorized version, or we call it the King James version.
That's right. And we're not King James only, and that's important because not so much in Britain, but certainly in America, there is quite a movement under that banner. Mm-hmm. And we are not there with them. We believe it's a great translation, the best by far, but it's not perfect. No translation can be. So we are not wedded to every single letter of the AV as spoken by God, as it were, even if it disagrees with the Hebrew and Greek, but then go and alter that. I mean, we're not in that camp.
And the TBS does things like promote translations in Spanish or whatever.
That's right. Because that's based important on the... because a lot of people don't realise that. Mm-hmm. And some people have dubbed us the King James Only Society, A, because of misunderstanding what I just said, and B, because they don't know we do anything else. We have got something like 50 translation projects on the go at the moment. And it might be a language such as Spanish or French with millions and millions and millions of speakers worldwide. But it might be some language in northern India, for example, or parts of Africa, which has only got a couple of thousand speakers, perhaps. But what we need to have a translation project is the Lord laying it upon the hearts of people to come to us with a proposition. And for those people, and they're rare, aren't they, to not only understand their own language, be a native speaker. We're not keen to work with people who've moved from that country and now live somewhere else, because you lose things. So ideally they need to be native speakers living in the land and using the language day to day, and they need to speak to us in English so that we can understand, and they need to have a grasp of biblical Greek and Hebrew. So you're looking for very rare people. What we can do, and we don't like doing it, but occasionally we will do this, we will try to bring out a preliminary edition, especially if there's nothing at all in the language that Christians can have, which is based on the authorized version, but only as a stepping stone to something better, which is actually derived from the original biblical languages.
Right.
So
what's the health of the Trinitarian Bible Society in 2019? How is it doing?
We've just brought out our latest annual report. The way the world would look at it, we had a financial deficit last year. They might say, oh, that's not doing very well. But there were reasons for that that were unusual. In terms of the work being done, the translations being prepared, the support of churches, which we're very keen to have, it's doing well. we believe, and the staff, which are hard to find, we have attracted, and not in only in Britain, but in the other four places where we have branches, we have attracted godly staff. We will not employ unbelievers. And we're not only not unbelievers, but we're not going to employ somebody who doesn't appreciate and love the authorized version. So we're looking for needles in haystacks here. We're looking for very rare people. But we, God sends them along. It's amazing.
So tell me about just the spiritual state of England and the UK, or London. How many? I mean, what is the spiritual state of the church life there? And in particular, you said it's a rare thing to have a church or individuals who have this traditional text view and love the authorized version.
I would qualify that with one comment that you need to be living near London to work for TBS, or ideally. I mean, there are people that travel 100 miles by train every day or come in 2 or 3 days a week because the traveling would otherwise be prohibitive. So we can and do employ people who don't live around London, but that would be the ideal. And that's what I used to go in every day. You need some people who are going to be there every day, even though the staff might be a mixture. But it's a useful way of gauging the state of the church, being in TBS. And I got to know more and more about this. And we have the speakers that go out and speak at 200-300 churches every year in Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales and England. So you can gauge the health of the church to some extent by those numbers of churches increasing, the ones that want speakers to come. And they might not be authorized version churches. This is good. So churches will have a speaker who is not there to sort of upset them and say, your Bible's rubbish, you need one of these, although there might be occasion to actually press the point gently. But they'll tell them about the work in the Spanish world or the grant work we do. We give away thousands upon thousands, millions of Bibles and scripture and gospels and smaller portions of scriptures, calendars, every year in 135 languages, 135 countries, 40-odd languages, something like that. So that is an enormous enterprise that is growing. And the latest annual report shows like comparisons of numbers. So in terms of what we set out to do is not to make a pile of money and flood the world with translations that, in our view, are not very good. That would be one way of doing it. Other societies do that. We are devoted to providing accurate translations, much smaller enterprise, but more valuable, in our view, to people all over the world. And God has enabled us to do that and mushroom the work, made it grow enormously. Even in the 20 years or more since I started, I've seen it grow a lot in those terms.
We'll make this, we've been talking almost an hour. I'm gonna close it up with two questions. So tell me, what do you think that the churches that you've visited in America, what could we learn from Christians in the UK, and then turn that around and say, what could Christians in the UK learn from what you've seen from Christians in the US?
Right. We've been coming to the USA since 1998, which is the year I joined TBS, and we came as a special sort of trip of a lifetime. Both reached the age of 50, probably never get here again. But because we met lovely Christian people that long weekend who were so hospitable. So that's one thing I think we really enjoy over here that we don't always see in Britain. Hospitality, friendliness, willingness to embrace strange people from England. Some churches, our church I hope is not like this, but we do recognise that we have failings in that area as well. Some churches in Britain are very insular. They had their services and they're out of the door, you know, half an hour later, if not earlier than that. And even in our own church, we have people for varying reasons who don't stay long. But we've always encouraged the stay for a cup of tea, have a chat, and be on the premises like an hour and a half later and have to be forced out of the door kind of ethos. So that's one thing that we really enjoy in America. One thing perhaps that American churches, in our view, and we've only ever really been to Reformed Baptist churches, so I'm only speaking from that perspective, mm-hmm. and we love that affinity that we have with them. But I think differences that we've noticed, and we've talked about this even today, we probably go farther than most, maybe too far, some might say, in terms of activity, youth clubs, outreach, Lord's Day meetings galore, compared with many churches we've been to in the States. They have two services on the Lord's Day. They might have an adult Bible hour beforehand, and they have a Wednesday night Bible study prayer meeting, usually.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else. No outreach. And if your church is in the middle of the countryside, you can't have an open-air meeting where there's no one living for miles around. I realise that. And you can't go knocking on doors like our minister does every week, because there aren't any doors nearby to knock on. So there are differences by geography and vicinity and so on. But I think one thing that British churches, some anyway, and the Tabernacle is a brilliant example, I think, they do better or more is outreach, evangelism. But it's very difficult with a church, say, in your situation, to work out ways of actually doing that. And we were talking earlier about a Sunday school and evangelistic Sunday school to go and not only your own youngsters, but find them from outside. How are you going to do that? Well, we have been to churches in more built-up areas in the States where that's not so much of a problem.
Right, right. Well, David, thank you so much. It's been great to get to know you, and you and I are going to be heading to Lynchburg this evening, and we'll be meeting some brothers there. But so good to have you guys and Monica, your wife, with us. And I found out you guys are just excellent drivers and travelers in Virginia. And we wish you God's blessings in the rest of your stay, and hope it's a very enjoyable trip for you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Blessings.
Thank you.